Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Some of the stories we look at this week include: do compliance professionals need a union? Jailed employees under the FCPA, the new normal for workplace policies and procedures, a new SOE, Management Risk Framework, three questions for KPMG, SFO investigation, and much more. Hope you will check out one of the latest additions to the Compliance Podcast Network, Trial of the Century, the Enron Trial, where with business journalist Lauren Steffi, who covered the case, I take a look at the issues around the trial, the witnesses, and the outcome. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, back again with Mr. Monitors himself, Jay Rosen, for This Week in FCPA, episode 290 for the week ending February 11th. 2021, the Super Sunday edition. Jay, Super Sunday is here. The NFL finally gets the game in the spotlight after weeks of just brutal PR. So, who do you have? Houday or Hollywood?
Houday with this orange hoodie, and my score is Cincinnati 30, LA 28.
Pretty bold opening maneuver. Well, while our audience cogitates on that, it looks like we're going to take a look at some of the week's top compliance and ethics stories. So, what say you?
I say kickoff is 3:03, and I'm looking forward to it. But let's have a little snack before we have that main appetizer and look at some of the top ethics and compliance stories from this week.
Well, Jay, our first story comes to us from Dick Kasson, and I must say, I don't know if it's one of the most controversial posts Dick's ever put up, but it goes in a direction, frankly, I had not ever considered in compliance, and he asks the question, do compliance officers need a union to represent them? Jay, you know, you come from the elite master class, so you've never been a union member. I, however, have been a card-carrying union member. It's an interesting question, and I would have thought the answer is no, because compliance officers are professionals, and professionals typically are not members of unions, but Dick points out that there are professionals as members of unions, and there have been for many, many years. Operating engineers, for instance, have had their own union for many, many years, but he goes into a little bit deeper dive and talks about some of the work of compliance professionals, particularly at financial institutions. And it is more data-focused than the type of compliance perhaps you and I have worked in over the years. And so he makes really some interesting points that perhaps in some industries, unionization would be appropriate for compliance professionals. Typically, you look at a union to standardize terms and conditions of work and negotiate salaries. So it's just an interesting article. And he answers his own question by thinking that perhaps we don't need, or I should say, compliance professionals don't need that right now, but it's something that he may be revisiting. So kudos to Dick for raising this. It's something that, as I said, I certainly had not considered, and it's something that compliance professionals may want to keep in mind down the road.
So next up, we have the second of three from the FCPA blog. This comes to us from Billy Jacobson, and he wants to know, did the DOJ go too far on the thorny issue of jailed employees? Many of an in-house compliance professional has spent a weekend consumed with handling the tricky questions presented when an employee finds themselves incarcerated in one emerging market or another. It's unclear, especially at first, whether the arrest was justified, as in most cases. And it's often the case that a friendly local police officer or magistrate has suggested that a payment would free the employee. How companies handle this scenario varies, often depending on the perceived justification. On January 21st, the DOJ issued an opinion procedure release, which Tom spoke about last week, and which speaks to the scenarios in ways that seem strange and not at all intuitive. In short, the DOJ sanctioned a $175,000 payment, almost certainly to a government official, to get the employee out of jail and allow a ship to continue on its way. Without reciting the details in the OPR, Billing notes that the following salient facts: a ship captain was incarcerated after inadvertently sailing his ship into the waters of country A. The captain had serious health issues and the detention was putting his life in danger. According to the DOJ, country A authorities did not, quote, provide any documentation authorizing his arrest or detention, close quote. Shortly after the detention, a third-party intermediary approached the company and demanded a payment to release the captain and permit the vessel to leave. In requesting an OPR, the company asked the Department of Justice whether it would bring an enforcement action against the company if they made a $175,000 payment to a third-party intermediary to cause country A to allow the ship leave its waters and the release of the captain. The DOJ answered no, it would not bring an enforcement action because if the payment were to be made. The DOJ based its decision on its view that the payment would not be made corruptly to or to obtain or retain business. While the situation faced by the company was certainly a difficult one, it's also one that's relatively common. That the DOJ essentially blessed the payments of $175,000 to circumvent country A's legal system is more than a little strange, especially in view of the scant analysis provided. The DOJ concluded that the payment would not be to obtain or retain business, noting simply that the company had no actual or anticipated business with country A. The DOJ failed, however, to address the obvious commercial interest that the company had in getting into country A in the first place. More egregiously, the OPR is completely silent on how the DOJ justified payment, while also acknowledging that the company may have violated the law. OPRs do not have the force of legal precedent, and companies cannot rely on them as a matter of law. Nevertheless, they do, as the DOJ is aware, have enormous value to companies in providing guidance, particularly concerning thorny situations. This OPR will certainly inform companies, will inform how companies handle this tricky scenario of an incarcerated employee in ways that may not promote respect for the rule of law in emerging markets. Given this, it seems a strange decision, and Billy, for one, would welcome more explication of the DOJ's rationale. Tom, what does Ingrid Fredin think about new workplace normal for policies and training?
So, Jay, this is a continuing series by Navex Global on their Risk and Compliance Matters blog, and today Ingrid looks at training and policy management. She really picks up four topics. Prioritize your access to technology, as there are two forces at play here, remote work and the continuing evolution of risk that you need to try and ameliorate through your program. Two, adapt to emerging and evolving risks, picking up from the Department of Justice in their 2020 update to the evaluation of corporate compliance programs, which said you need to evaluate, assess, and manage your risks on an ongoing basis. And if your risks change, then you need to evaluate or update your risk assessment. So obviously the return to work or hybrid work is a change from work from home. ESG frameworks are rapidly evolving, so your risks are going to change there. Three, have a clarity of expectations. Certainly we're living in unprecedented times, and I think that's going to continue. but make sure that people understand what are the rules and what are the rules for social media, what are the rules for going outside the organization. And then finally, take a look at the evolution of your training and communications in your overall program. Remember, your training has to be targeted and your communications need to be ongoing. So some good information from Ingrid and Navex Global. Jay, what about a potential new SEO risk management framework?
Thanks, Tom. This is the third of three as promised from the FCPA blog. The authors are Alexandra Gillies and Thomas Shipley. And we take a look at state-owned enterprises. Do they pose challenges to standard compliance measures? Risk-based due diligence is the foundation of how companies prevent corruption. Its logic implies that companies proactively manage their risk exposure, avoiding the most problematic third parties in deals and mitigating risks associated with others. The Natural Resource Governance Institute, NRGI, has compiled research into state-owned enterprises, SOEs, corruption in their extractive sector, which reveals some of the practical limitations to the above approach. Because international oil and mining companies may be less able to avoid or influence SOEs, these state enterprises pose a challenge to standard compliance measures. Companies, including producers, commodity traders, and extractive sector suppliers, often have a fewer options for transactions with SOEs, and many companies partnering with one is required, particularly for companies that produce oil and gas. As a result, some of the extractive sector companies have ended up engaging in or enabling corruption. Recent enforcement cases reveal how a number of companies have bribed SOE officials. In other instances, companies have made payments to SOEs that were then misappropriated or have worked with partners with inappropriate political connections. In these instances, risk-based due diligence failed to prevent companies from moving forward or establishing sufficient mitigation. Given this misalignment between standard risk-based due diligence practices and many SOE transactions, NRGI set out to identify what additional measures would better prevent these harmful corruption trends from reoccurring. They analyzed over 100 past corruption cases and consulted widely across the industry, including 18 large oil, gas, mining companies, and anti-corruption experts and activists. Here are three key messages that stand out. First, not everything can be left to case-by-case decision-making. Given the risk, companies should draw red lines from the start. Second, the prevailing risk-based approach is too inward-looking. Company executives should also weigh the risk of enabling corruption and societal harms. And finally, in SOE transactions that carry high risk, companies should invest more, not less, in controls in building a nuanced picture of risk. Given the inevitability and sensitivity of some SOE engagements, some companies leave important anti-corruption tools on the table. While many companies undertake thorough due diligence, others do only the bare minimum of basic checks, especially for short-term transactions, when the SOE is a client or when the company considers the SOE as an unavoidable entity. SOEs do not fit easily into standard diligence frameworks, but companies can and should invest in gathering a full picture of corruption risks by adopting additional due diligence approaches. In high-risk partnerships, companies should also make use of available good practices, especially ahead of new engagements. Risk-based due diligence will continue to play a core role in helping companies avoid corruption, but certain scenarios, such as partnerships with extractive SOEs, make clear the need for supplemental approaches. By learning from past challenges and embracing additional safeguards, companies can rise to meet the challenge. Tom, why don't you tell our listeners what are the three questions from KPMG and the Carilion Tribunal?
So, Jay, this comes to us from Neil Hodge, writing in Compliance Week, and KPMG is involved in a now huge lawsuit in the United Kingdom over an audit it gave to the now defunct UK firm Carilion, and including a clean audit right before it went belly up, and it had given prior clean audits as well. The company got into really big trouble because when the financial reporting council, the FRC, that's the group in the United Kingdom, investigated KPMG, they lied, cheated, and stole. And so they created false documents to give to the FRC. So there's three key points here, and they're really not going to sound too new or different. So number one, don't invent documents to lie to regulators. While lying is always a bad move, when you create documents to base your lie on, it's an even bigger scale and deception. So don't create false documents to perpetrate fraud. Number two, KPMG tried to blame the junior employees. That's just another name for rogue employees or companies that refuse to take responsibility, wanting to create a patsy. It was partners in charge of this audit, and they didn't do their job. So blaming the alleged junior employees is just a derivation of the rogue employee. And then don't make admissions that are going to backfire. The chief executive of KPMG told the FRC tribunal early on in the case it was clear misconduct had occurred and that the FRC was misled. In closing argument, the firm's counsel said there were no systemic problems and none was alleged. Well, when you're counsel and you make arguments in direct contrast to what your CEO has admitted, you look very, very bad, and it lessens your credibility. So KPMG has not made itself very proud in this incident. There's now a huge civil suit in the United Kingdom, and the day of reckoning may be coming, Jay. We'll be right back with more of This Week in FCPA after a quick word from our sponsors.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So on our next story, we go back over to the pond into the UK. This comes to us from the Wall Street Journal Risk and Compliance Journal from our good friend Menke Sun. And the UK launches review of the Serious Fraud Office over Unioil bribery case. The Attorney General for England and Wales has launched a review of the Serious Fraud Office over problematic issues identified in a bribery case linked to the oil services firm Unioil Group. The Attorney General, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, Suella Braverman, has appointed David Calvert-Smith, a former director of public prosecutions and a high court judge, to lead the independent review of the white-collar crime prosecuting agency. Mr. Calvert-Smith has led several independent reviews at other agencies, including one into alleged racism within the police service. He will conduct the review with a team that includes the Deputy Chief Inspector of Her Majesty's Crown Prosecution Service Inspectorate, which oversees the SFO. In 2020, the SFO said it would review its conduct in the prosecution of individuals in its Unioil case after a judge at the same time questioned the nature of communications between a private investigator and the agency. The Attorney General's review will focus on what went wrong in the SFO's Unioil case and what changes are needed at the agency to ensure that problems identified in the judgment, including disclosure issues and contracts with third parties, won't happen again. An SFO spokesman said, "We welcome the appointment of Sir David Calvert-Smith and will fully cooperate with his review." This review comes after Paul Bond, a defendant who was found guilty of involvement in a Unioil-linked bribe scheme, appealed his conviction at a London court in December. Mr. Bond filed his appeal after a ruling earlier that month overturned the conviction of one of his co-defendants, Ziad Akhlai, a former Iraq territory manager for Unioil. This announcement is welcome, but only if the terms of the reference go beyond mere encouragement to accept learnings and steps of improvement. What happened here was somewhere between calamitous ineptitude and cynical and purposeful interference with the legitimacy of criminal proceedings. Where on the scale does this impropriety lie? Who at the SFO will answer for it? These are the questions to which the defendants in this case deserve answers. We would welcome the appointment of Sir David. Everybody likes having Sir David around in this matter. And the commencement of the inquiry. We look forward to reading his report and his conclusions on the many questions that remain unanswered. Messrs. Akhlai and Bond have argued that the SFO improperly communicated with a private investigator for Atta Asani and his two sons, who together owned and controlled the Monaco-based Unioil. The Attorney General said that Mr. Calvert Smith would aim to report his findings by the end of May. Ms. Braverman will then update the UK Parliament on the results of the review and the government's response. Aziz Rahman, a senior partner with an expertise in white-collar crime who was not involved in this matter, said that the appointment of Mr. Calvert Smith is an excellent choice. He said that while it's too early to tell if the review mandate would lead to structural changes at the SFO, the review looks set to be very robust and a thorough look at the workings of the SFO. It's going to be crucial to the SFO's future because of the steps the Attorney General took. It's pretty unprecedented. Tom, what does Mr. ESG Lawrence Heim have on his mind this week?
So Jay talks about EU companies pushing the EU Commission on mandatory human rights due diligence. They want to have something called, acronym, MHREDD. So MHRED, I don't know if that's MRED or whatever. But here's the 5 points. Number one, it applies to all businesses in the UK. Rather than excluding smaller companies, it should ensure proportionality. Two, the legislation should oblige businesses to carry on proactive due diligence and across all operations of the value chain. Candace Towle would certainly second that nomination. Rather than focus on after closing audits, it should be an ongoing process. So here the five steps in the lifecycle management of third-party relationships would be an appropriate model to look at. They, to the extent there's legislation backing this up, there should be engagement with the affected groups. And finally, there needs to be real legal consequences, i.e. administrative penalties for companies that fail to follow this. So there were over 100 companies and investors that submitted this letter. And when you have that many people asking for this type of robust regulatory oversight, I really think it speaks to the desire for companies to have this in place, Jay. So, Jay, why are CCOs, why do they believe self-reporting is a hard sell now?
Thank you. This comes to us from Corporate Compliance Insights, and the author is Evren Essen from ECI. Stronger and more frequent communication between the Department of Justice and the ethics and compliance profession would certainly help to ensure greater understanding of DOJ guidance across companies and organizations, as well as to elevate the importance of E&C to strong, sustainable businesses. That is one of the principal conclusions of a recent survey of corporate compliance officers conducted by the Ethics and Compliance Initiative, ECI. While corporate compliance officers and other leaders in the profession understand the importance of an ethics and compliance to culture and DOJ guidance to terms of compliance, many indicate that they really don't have enough information about how the DOJ makes decisions behind incentives and declinations to encourage full and timely cooperation. The survey was conducted by ECI and underwritten by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Institute for Legal Reform. ECI asked approximately 250 chief compliance officers about the value and impact of four primary DOJ policy or guidance documents that communicate the criteria used by the DOJ to evaluate the effectiveness of corporate compliance programs. The survey found further sought CCO input about ways the DOJ could improve and incentivize corporate compliance and encourage corporate self-disclosure. Let's look at incentives and credits. It's reasonable to assume that the DOJ's goal in issuing guidance documents is to encourage self-disclosure and cooperation by companies when violations occur. ECI's survey showed that an average of 54% of the compliance officers believe that the DOJ's policies would make them more likely to disclose. However, there was a direct relationship between the DOJ's consistency in awarding credit and CCOs indicating that their company would be more likely to self-disclose. CCOs offered some suggestions in the survey as to how the DOJ could further incentivize corporate compliance programs. First, providing examples of E&C programs that were influential in DOJ's declination decisions. Next, providing more detail of enforcement actions, improving guidance documents, and engaging more with companies. Next, providing credit for company efforts to build a strong culture. Next, diminishing QTAM action, and the company maintains an effective compliance program in a situation where employees fail to report internally. And finally, eliminating the threat of debarment or exclusion for companies with effective ethics and compliance programs. Regardless of the amount of information available, putting a best practices corporate compliance program in place can offer significant dividends in terms of the discount given towards final fines that when they're imposed. But now let's look at educating the board of directors. The survey found that the extent to which CCOs brief various stakeholder groups about the DOJ's issuance of guidelines varied by policy document. Every communication from the DOJ is looked at by CCOs for their implications it holds for the organizations, and CCOs are most likely to brief the EC team and then the legal team. Taking information on DOJ guidelines updates to leadership and to the board is significant and helps protect the company, particularly because of the obligation that board members have for oversight of compliance programs. Recent rulings require the board members actively engage in oversight and ensure that the corporate compliance programs are active as well as effective. Open and honest two-way communication about corporate compliance, both internally and externally, is critically important for a robust program that meets and exceeds DOJ's guidance and creates a strong culture of integrity. CCOs and the ethics and compliance professionals are as committed today as they were when guidance documents were originally introduced and communicating and working closely with the DOJ. They also are eager to learn from the DOJ, and we hope that the DOJ will continue to work with the ethics and compliance community to create these open, transparent, and honest lines of communication. So, Tom, now let me ask you the question. What comes next for ABC and the Olympics?
Jay, in a really interesting article, Professor Andy Spaulding reviewed the Olympic and FIFA procurement process of selection of sites, or as what he called the mega sports selections. And he said that 2018 and between 2014 and 2018 was a tipping point, certainly around bribery and corruption and holding these mega sport events at places with very bad human rights and corruption problems. It really culminated with Russia hosting the Sochi Winter Olympics and the FIFA Men's World Cup. China, of course, is problematic as well. And reforms were put in place in 2017. And so going forward, we're going to see summer games in Paris in 2024, the U.S. in 2028, and Australia in 2032. The 2026 Winter Games will be in Italy, 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand for and then the 2026 Men's FIFA World Cup will be in the triumvirate of U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Andy has been really at the forefront of helping the Olympic Committee put model contracts in place, that it contains both human rights clauses and internationally recognized anti-corruption standards. I was part of a team that helped him with the Paris Olympics, and he has really put a lot of work into helping the Olympics put policies and procedures in place to prevent corruption. I really didn't work on the human rights side of things. So he's got an upcoming book about it that I can't wait. It's supposed to be published next month. But his piece in the Global Anti-Corruption blog really summarizes this in what should be the world's hope for a clean selection of games and a selection of sites where the countries are not problematic at best. Jay, what does the coolest guy in compliance have to say for us about the Spotify imbroglio?
Well, this comes to us from Matt's Radical Compliance blog, and he's got a two-part rant, I'd say. In part one, he looks at the question behind Spotify and Joe Rogan. Sometimes the CEO says something so wrong-headed about corporate priorities that the statement cries out for a close read, such as the case with Daniel Ek, chief executive of Spotify, and what he said last week about Joe Rogan and misinformation on the Spotify platform. Rogan posted an interview with one Robert Malone, a supposed immunologist, who these days spends his time pushing disinformation about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Twitter, for example, has already banned Malone for his quackery about right-wing media and the right-wing media crowd who hang on his every word. As Rogan's interview with Malone gained traction among conservatives and anti-vax conspiracy theorists, credible doctors decided that it had enough, and hundreds of them signed on to an open letter to Spotify. Next came the musicians, Neil Young, the polio survivor who keeps on rocking in the free world at 76 years old, pulled all his music from Spotify rather than share the platform. Other musicians such as Joni Mitchell and DRRA and Niels Lofgren followed suit. Finally, Spotify announced this week that it will start adding content advisories to Rogan's episodes. Spotify harm and censors. What caught Matt's eyes was how Mr. X, Spotify CEO, tried to frame his company's role in the mess. In that announcement of the new rules, he said, "We know we have a critical role to play in supporting creator expression while balancing it with the safety of our users. In that role, it's important to me that we don't take on the position of being a content censor while also making sure that there are rules in place and consequences for those who violate them." Matt's beef with the statement is the use of the word censor, unquote. Companies don't censor. Governments censor. Companies edit, review, and otherwise decide material that they may publish to their audience, but they don't censor. Another one who's tried this argument before, Mark Zuckerberg. During the 2020 election, Zuckerberg appeared on Fox News to talk about social media's responsibility for fact-checking. And here's the quote from Zuckerberg. "I just believe strongly that Facebook shouldn't be the arbiter of truth for everything that people say online. Private companies probably shouldn't be, especially these platform companies, shouldn't be in the position for doing that." So understand what Zuckerberg did there in those sentences. He cleverly cloaked an outrageous stance in meek prohibitive terms, but an outrageous stance remains, because if you rephrase Zuckerberg's point in the positive, he's saying, "I just believe strongly that people should be allowed to say whatever they want." Well, that doesn't sit well with your brain, does it? If anyone can do anything they want online, that has the power to cause enormous harm to people's lives. Eck just doesn't want that person to be him. So Zuckerberg doesn't want that responsibility either. This evokes the specter of censorship, and uses clever phrasing to dodge the real question: how much responsibility does a technology platform have for unethical or illegal uses of its product? In part two, the drama continues. By the end of last week, things got worse. Old podcast episodes surfaced where Rogan used racial slurs against blacks, including the repeated use of the N-word. Rogan apologized for that over the weekend, but now Spotify has a bigger program. At least with the anti-vax nonsense, one can argue that Rogan is just a clueless idiot, but racial slurs make him look mean, like a mean-spirited idiot. Eck, however, doubled down on his decision to keep working with Rogan. He circulated a memo to employers on Sunday, which opened with, quote, "Not only are some of Rogan's comments incredibly hurtful, but I want to make it clear that they don't represent the values of the company." Except Eck then went on for another eight paragraphs of how Spotify will continue to work with Rogan. Newsflash, when you say that person doesn't represent our values, but you're going to keep working with them, guess what? That's a statement of values about your company. Eck tried to dodge ethical implications of his decision by saying that Spotify is merely a platform for a range of views rather than a publisher of content. Here's his trickery to try to get out of things. "While I strongly condemn what Joe has said and agree with his decision to move past, I realize some will want more, and I want to make one point very clear. I do not believe that silencing Joe is the answer. We should have clear lines around content and take action when they're crossed, but canceling voices is a slippery slope. Looking at the issue more broadly, it's critical thinking and open debate that powers real and necessary progress." As Matt said in last week's post about Spotify, this is the tripe that uses trigger words like silencing, slippery slope to conjure up feelings, all so that Eck can abdicate his fundamental responsibility. Eck is just using scary words, censor, silencing, slippery slope, to distract everyone from the truth, but that's what he's doing. That's nothing new, of course. CEOs have long tried to duck the tough ethical choices that might cost them money or alienate certain portions of their customer base. In today's world, however, when companies profess their supposed ethical values so publicly and all parties can see and dissect corporate action so easily, we shouldn't be surprised that tensions then follow. That seems to be the case here at Spotify. Consumers and employees have one sense of where Spotify's ethical line should be drawn. Eck has another, and after so many years of encouraging open debate within the company, the principal has now come back to bite Eck on the ethical rear. Tom, that's the end of the articles for this week. Why don't you start off and tell us about some of the cornucopia of podcasts we have for our listeners?
Sure, Jay. As you know, this month on The Compliance Life, I'm featuring Ellen Smith. And this week's episode, Ellen moves in-house to her first position. Over on 12 O'Clock High, a podcast on business leadership, Richard Lummis and I engage in something that's probably near and dear to your heart, Jay. Every year during Oscar season, we review four previous Best Picture winners for business ethics and leadership lessons. This year, we've got Schindler's List, Gladiator, A Man for All Seasons, and Platoon. Schindler's List was extraordinarily difficult to watch again, as I'm sure you appreciate, but we did, and we have some business leadership and ethical lessons. That episode is up. Gladiator goes up next week. Once again, the trial of the century, the Enron trial, has posted. It's a five-part podcast series, which I did with my good friend and colleague, Lauren Steffi. Lauren was a business columnist for the Houston Chronicle who covered the trial, and we went back and revisited. 2021 was the 20th anniversary of the collapse of Enron. It was also the 15th anniversary of the trial. So we thought it was a good time to look at the trial. And finally, Jay, I had a special two-part Sunday book review. For those who may not know, I do an annual or rather weekly book review, appropriately on Sunday, because it's named the Sunday Book Review, where I talk about books that apply to compliance officers, leadership, ethics, or whatever else might be interesting to me. And this two-part series, I looked at 10 books on ethical leadership from Notre Dame's Deloitte Center for Ethical Leadership. There's some fascinating titles on this. Last week was part one, and we concluded, or will conclude this coming Sunday with part two. So check out the Sunday Book Review. It's a nice, light, fun kind of weekend listening, relatively short at about 10 minutes. And here's some of my ideas on some top books. What do you have for us, Jay?
Well, we're still promoting the fact that CCI has released your new ebook called FCPA 2021, The Year in Review. And Tom, how much does it cost to get to read about the year in review?
Well, Jay, you have to turn your computer on. It's going to cost you some electricity. So there's some cost. I can't really categorize it at this point. But the book itself is free, Jay. That's zero cost to you in the great state of California, and including, Jay, no taxes. So rarely can you get something in California for no taxes. Well, you can get this one for no taxes. So check it out, available on Corporate Compliance Insights.
Earlier in the podcast, Tom, I stepped out there, and I'm calling my shot, Cincinnati 30.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of This Week in FCPA. I hope you'll join us again next week, where we look at all of the stories of this week in FCPA. For my frozen colleague, Jay Rosen, this is Tom Fox. Thanks so much for listening. This is Tom Fox again. Thank you for listening to this episode of This Week in FCPA. I hope you will check out the newest podcast to the Compliance Podcast Network, which premieres on Tuesday, February 8th. We're going to look at the intersection of ESG and compliance with a special 10-part series of various topics with some ESG and compliance luminaries. I know you'll enjoy this special series, so check it out, premiering on the Compliance Podcast Network. As an added bonus, it will be in video pod format on YouTube. So if you like to consume information via YouTube, it will also be on the Compliance Podcast Network YouTube channel. If you'd like any more information on the topics we've discussed, you can obviously check them out in the show notes. You can reach out to myself, Tom Fox, at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. You can reach Jay at jrosen@affiliatedmonitors.com. I hope you'll join us again next week, where Jay and I will be back to take a look at next week's top stories. This Week in FCPA is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.